Well, this is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and I'm very, very pleased that we're finally able to record our interviews because we have a very important book. Diana Johnson, the well-known journalist, very highly respected, but has written this great book, Circle in the Darkness, Memoir of a World Watcher, and we're really thrilled to be talking to her. Are you there, Diana?
Yes, I'm here.
I have to say, to me, this is a remarkable book. I think anybody wants to understand events, particularly, it stretches out from World War II to now, and everything in this book seems to be still shaking and moving. I was thinking in today for the interview that here you are in the book talking about the assassination of the Swedish leader, Olof Palme. And only a couple of days ago, we had the headlines that they now claim to know who the assassin was, except that he's gone. And they want to turn the page and say that it's not of any importance. Your book shows us it's very, very important. And of course, now we have the news that the so-called Kosovar leader, Mr. Thaçi, if that's how you pronounce it, is back in the news. In your book, Circle in the Darkness, tells us so much about what happened in Kosovo. It's a great historical account, but my goodness, it's absolutely pertinent to today. I guess let me start with one point that I've been telling listeners to the Taylor Report, that you describe going to Europe with your husband and who was a journalist, and something very striking there for me. You say that he was the working journalist and you were sort of in a position to watch, maybe assist. But I got the impression that gave you tremendous insight at how the journalism functions and the damage that it can do to people's understanding. You used a phrase, a very simple but clear point. You say that stories are always framed and that once the frame is set, you can have all the conscientious journalists you want. But frame always dictates. You told several stories about your husband trying to get a kind of a clear picture of events, but the editing and the headlines distorted what he was actually reporting. What about that idea of this problem we live with of the, which you had insight into because you, in a way, were the observer. You were watching it. You weren't actually in it.
But I went on to be in it. I mean, that was an early part of my life when I saw how mainstream journalism was working. But then I had my whole career of non-mainstream journalism where I also saw all the things that were being distorted by the mainstream media, were being not reported, or you mentioned the Palma case or Kosovo. I mean, these are ongoing stories because these are undisclosed and unpunished crimes that we're living with, the crimes of empire, you might say. And at the time that I was married to Herb, the frame was the Cold War, and foreign correspondents were simply there in order to report within the framework of this great football game between the United States and the Soviet Union, and everything was supposed to be framed within that context. The context changed, of course, and now it's what the bad Russians are doing. They're not communists anymore, but they are still there. And so that's the frame today. And now China, you you have that as a frame.
Yes, and we get this picture that's so important that we are now living in a time when there is a lot of referencing back to other episodes in history to understand where we are. Your book really gives us a wonderful insight into that period called 68. And there's so many legends around it, but you have, to me, cast a lot of light on some of the motivations and outlooks that were people thought were quite revolutionary, but really were not. Of course, this is seems to me very pertinent when we talk about the yellow vests. You were in France, and you were associating with all these major figures who really have not panned out as anything very significant. The rest of their lives after 68 are very kind of dubious careers.
When you get a lot of people together, whenever you get a lot of people together that seem to, are you hear me? Wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Yay.
When I was reading, I got the impression you might have called one of those chapters Althusser's children. I hadn't realized how many these figures that we seem to know, like Combendy and is his name Foucault? Pardon me, I'm a North American who doesn't have any language. They were under. They apparently were students, and you would have thought he'd have that they had more respect for the teacher, but they seem to be, actually, I like your terms, you're very frank and good English, you called Combendy a brat. He's certainly a brat in his later years, terrible character.
Well, he always was, but actually, to go back to that, The May 68 brought together two main tendencies, I would say, that were quite at odds with each other, but all seemed to be, you get a movement against something. I'm sure that's true today in big movements. You have a lot of people and you don't realize that they're at cross purposes in some ways. They were cross purposes because on the one hand, you had an ultra-left, let's say a Trotskyist left, a Maoist left, or just an ultra-left, who all thought that the Communist Party of France wasn't revolutionary enough. I mean, it seems very funny, but that they were very hostile to the Communist Party because the Trotskyist idea that Stalinism stopped the real revolution and so on. And so they were trying to outflank the Communist Party on its left by being more revolutionary. On the other hand, you had the hedonist tendency, which was Combendy, who, by the way, was never a student of Althusser. He was in the sociology department at Nanterre, and he was wanting, his big issue was free male access to women's dormitories, which is quite a different kind of issue. Now, as a matter of fact, it's the hedonists who won out with all the slogans, do what you want, et cetera. Now, that may have sounded at a time when there was a certain amount of discipline, very revolutionary. But in fact, do what you want is a perfect capitalist slogan. And do what you want, buy what you want, pay for what you want. I mean, actually, that hedonism turned out to be perfectly compatible with neoliberalism. And today, they combine. And of course, then they go into human rights, because human rights is a kind of do what you want ideology. And that's the ideology of neoliberalism.
Mm-hmm. It You explained it very clearly. I always think of conditions now and then. Your book shed so much light on it. This matter of you found in conversations with those who emerged as leaders that they were profoundly anti-Soviet, that they were always looking to correct you and anti-Soviet in your writing. Fortunately for us all, you didn't go along. You're a born skeptic, are you not? You'd never quite join in with these things and allow the sort of the current enthusiasm to change your direction.
Well, I'm a born skeptic, and I'm even more of a skeptic. I mean, I just get more skeptical. That's a little bit the title of the book. The more you know, the more you know, the more you know you don't know. I have a feeling that no system really works. I mean, every political system, every ism sounds great, but it gets corrupted because people learn how to cheat with it, et cetera, et cetera. And but I feel that it's a duty to criticize your own system. I'm not only one who feels that way. I think a lot of the responsible left has felt that our duty is to restrain our own power in our own countries from being aggressive and making wars. And it's really not my business to tell the Soviet Union how it should be. That doesn't mean I approve or disapprove. I don't think my approval or disapproval is of any importance. My approval or disapproval should be part of my democratic right to criticize my own system. And I'm not going to spend my time criticizing the designated enemy of the United States, because criticism won't do anything to help the United States, but it will help build up hostility against the other country and help contribute to a war atmosphere. So I consider it ever my business to criticize the internal affairs of countries that the United States is targeting.
That is something it seems to me you adhere to that admirably well. A few times I've heard Nomsky say that, but then he uses his own line, as you point out in your book. I've heard him say, well, the country that I have a response to change is my own country. And I've always thought, well, that's a good starting point. But in your book, you also deal with the fact Noam Chomsky bought into some of these new ideas, such as humanitarian intervention or responsibility to protect. That was a moment, was it not, that the United Nations talked into the idea that they should license interference by powers, major powers?
No, that's a horrible thing, because, of course, by saying, well, it's all right if something terrible is going to happen, because, of course, how do you know it's going to happen? This is based on, if there's going to be a genocide or a massacre in a country, you have the right to go in and prevent it. Well, of course, it's very easy, and that's what happened in Libya. Somebody who was very close to the United States, he studied the United States, but had become the human rights office of Libya, went to Geneva and told the NGOs for human rights, and they went to the UN saying, oh, there's going to be a terrible genocide. Gaddafi is going to kill all these people. Well, that was totally invented. It's not true, but it fit into the responsibility to protect. So then say, oh, well, we have to do something to prevent this terrible crime that would be committed. And well, of course, what they did was destroy the country. But the thing about that responsibility to protect, that whose responsibility could be, the only power that could do that is NATO. Well, in fact, there's a license to kill Tomato because it's the only country that has the means to go destroy a country to prevent the crime that somebody says is going to be committed. So this is a total fraud, and it's I think that all the crimes that I've witnessed on the part of the United States hegemony wars, I think the destruction of Libya is the most horrible because it really destroyed a country that was the most prosperous in the sense of ordinary people living well in Africa, and also a government that was planning to use its oil wealth to finance a currency that would help African nations be developed. And we totally destroyed that. It was a war against Africa, against sub-Saharan Africans, as a matter of fact, all pretending to be a human rights adventure. It's really the most scandalous of all of the crimes, to my mind.
It was almost the lowest point. There was when the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, I guess his name was, actually participated very actively in the destruction of Cote d'Ivoire. That was, to me, at least, I thought we must have hit bottom now, because he was actually almost micromanaging the destruction of a socialist government in Ivory Coast.
Well, that's absolutely right. By the way, crime has been undone. I don't think that it was a terrible crime, but I don't think the results have been quite as disastrous. For one thing, I think that the person I can't remember names, the one they overthrew and arrested has been found innocent.
Yeah, so but that not allowed, not allowed to return home.
Yeah, but that's very bad at the level of one country. But the destruction of Libya affected all of Africa.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, Gaddafi had a program. He gave good jobs to Africans, and in fact, a lot of the war was against Black Africans, part of Arab Libyans who were in fact Islamic extremists, because those were enemies of Gaddafi at home. They were pretending to be, oh, we want American-style democracy. In fact, they were extreme Islamists in Benghazi, who had always been his opponents, and who didn't like his turning toward Africa, sub-Saharan Africa. And Gaddafi's program was to help develop Africa, for Africans to stay in Africa. And one of the results of destroying Libya has been a flood which abates time, but a large number of Africans desperate leaving Africa and trying to get into Europe, where there's no work, not much work for them either. And this whole disaster is a result of this stupid criminal war, which one of its purposes, as you see from some documents, is that Hillary Clinton thought she could strut around as a presidential candidate, as the heroine of UP. She wanted that war as something that she could look, I got rid of a dictator, and you heard her chortling when she heard that Gaddafi had been brutally murdered.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Diana Johnson, author of Circle of the Darkness, Memoir of a World Watcher. I want to say, by the way, inter alia, that you're obviously homekeeper. I really hope that you give some thought to perhaps sharing some of your journals.
No, that's not true. I'm not a journal keeper.
I'm sorry, I didn't get.
You said that it was obvious that I was a journal keeper, and I'm not a journal keeper.
No. You know, your information is so precise. Your recollection of it, conversations with really very important historical figures. I assumed there must be a whole, raft of pages.
It didn't work that way. It worked this way. I have copies of articles I wrote. For instance, the conversation with Dr. Sartawi. I recorded that in an article I wrote for In These Times. So I looked it up, but I never had time to keep a diary. I mean, I don't know how people find the time to keep a detailed diary. I was always too busy. I never had time to keep a diary. I wish I had, but I kept articles. I kept some notes for articles, but I kept a personal diary.
Ah. And what we need is to collect your articles. I remember I.F. Stone did that. And, Stone's old articles collected are really wonderful things to have.
Well, it takes a publisher to publish them. But I wish they'd start with, I want to see readers start with my book. Because in a way, the book also profits from, benefits from hindsight. As I point out sometimes, I didn't always get the point right at the time. And so some things I sort of understood, but not quite. And it's watching all of this parade of events has sharpened my perception of things in the past. So I think that my book gives a better account than the articles themselves.
Mm-hmm. Our listeners should know that I was impressed with just how diligent you have been in your work as a journalist. I'm afraid we have to add the word activist. You helped form anti-war committees. You worked for the Green Party in Europe. But you are one of the people who goes on the scene. Your trip to Yugoslavia, that of course as a student, but later at the time of the conflict there, and the fact that you also, Libya, you definitely have that important element of, is missing now from most journalism, of spending time and not just hanging out at the center or being steered around by the people who want to make sure you write what they want. Those qualities make an exceptionally readable book, but also we don't seem to have the journalists do this anymore.
Well, I think maybe you have a few journalists on the internet who are very good journalists. From Max Blumenthal, I think of, and he's not the only one. But the difference is between back in the Cold War, when I was the wife of Associated Press chief of bureau in Bonn, when it was capital of Germany. At that time, there was quite a press corps of regular correspondents living in Bonn. Now, there are many fewer journalists abroad. They send in a team of television reporters or something when there's a crisis. So you don't have as many people as you used to who stay in the country, because my husband at the time, I mean, he was talking to all kinds of politicians, including opposition politicians, if you want to. And when you don't have foreign correspondents, because they've been largely eliminated, what happens is the American journalist goes to the capital of the country who's having its crisis, and he goes to the American embassy, and the information officer explains what the story is all about. He sends him to a local source that will tell the story the way the embassy wants the story to be told. So he has a local source, and the local source will give him the version that the United States wants, and then he'll report that. And that's the way it works, really. That's the way it works.
We also have this phenomenon, which, by the way, I want to ask you if you think this is a passing, maybe fall, changing because of the new political power, arrangement of powers, multilateralism, but we had this thing called the NGO and the human rights groups. And I have to tell you, as a partisan, it strike me as almost intelligence organizations. And one of the names that I know that you knew is Mr. Is it Kushner? Media relied a tremendous amount, or has, I don't know if it's going to go on. I guess that's what I'm asking, is this passing out of being, this business of everybody turning to the NGOs, because there seems to be greater and greater suspicion of their role in guiding journalists and pushing policies.
Absolutely. In fact, you see, governments, I think in the old days you had newspapers who had their own correspondents on the spot, and you had, it was the foreign ministry of a country or the State Department who had its experts that were studying a country. Now there's a tremendous dependence on NGOs who are all fighting for some cause somewhere, and think tanks, which are financed by basically the military industrial complex, who are making policy because they are in contact with Congress. And I think now you see policy is really made, is very heavily privatized, like everything else that should be public. Like there are in Afghanistan or places like that, we privatize the army with mercenaries, and it's a little bit the same. So there's somehow there's no policy that is really under anything you could call political, local, democratic control. It's all these interest groups, and that often they're human rights that they are defending is of some discontented minority in some country whose discontent is motivated by the United States to weaken the government of mm-hmm. the country in question.
Again, we're speaking to Diana Johnson. Their book is Circle in the Darkness, Memoir of a World Watcher. And Diana, I want to mention also your father's book, and I think you were blessed in a wonderful man, Paul Johnson, his book, From Mad to Madness, Inside Pentagon War Planning, which is actually what he did. In a way, I think being the daughter of Paul Johnson and then living in Yugoslavia, you were almost overqualified. You, with that kind of background, it's really empowered you in many ways. I think you must have often found yourself talking to people who thought of themselves as world changers and socialists or what, and anti-imperialists, but really didn't have the kind of foundation that you, I guess we could say, inherited. And one last thing on that, it's very moving, and I hope people will buy the book and read it. Your account of your father's attitude and his last days. That was a very touching picture that you gave us, which just tells us about all families and the stresses that they go through. And he's such a remarkable man. Could you talk about his influence on you and the way his life ended and your sort of what it did for you?
Well, look, that's very easy. I owe tremendously a lot to my father. He had great experience. He had been in India during the war. He was in China, the last moment of the Chinese Revolution. So he gave me a perspective on the world. And he was also skeptical. I inherited the skepticism and the curiosity. I inherited also a sense of trying to understand the other point of view, and being very hostile to Manichaean, oh, we're the good guys and they're the bad guys. I inherited that attitude as well as learning from his experience, and indeed, I owe everything to my father.
When you were so close to somebody who's in the power circles, particularly when we're talking nuclear, and there are many readers now who did not live through that, but I suppose you could say we're entering a phase where they better be thinking about it. His book, Mad to Madness, and your book would, I think, arm people in a way they need to be armed. And that, to me, leads to this question of the situation we find ourselves with. President Putin of Russia has made written a rather long piece. I forget where that's published, but I'm sure you've seen it. And he's also beginning to say on this 75th anniversary of the defeat of Nazism, we need to go back and have a look at what the Security Council is and what the United Nations is, because we seem to have a superpower that doesn't think the rules apply anymore. I want to know what you think of the thesis coming from the Russian president.
Well, alas, he's right. And the whole campaign against Russia really began, what was it, 2007, I think, when he gave a speech at the Munich Security Conference, saying that he, against a, you know, what do you call it, a unipolar world, meaning that, you know, the United States runs everything. And he spoke out very frankly and, you know, where we want a friendly world with equal rights for all countries and a multipolar world. And that to the United States was intolerable. And the whole anti-Putin, anti-Russia campaign began right then. It is unacceptable to the United States power system, which is a deep state, and that shows up today because in a lot of ways, simply cannot tolerate the idea that the United States is not the world leader. To them, doesn't go. And so we're now seeing a new buildup of nuclear weapons as a result of simply the fact that Russia didn't want to be told everything to do by the United States. It wanted to be itself. This country's wanting to be themselves is not allowed. And that's why we have a growing nuclear arms race, our wealth being poured into nuclear weapons when you have tremendous social problems in the United States that are not being addressed, because the whole power system of the United States is focused on world hegemony, not on the welfare of the American people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's and something too, your American roots, we would really like to know your thoughts about this is always the conundrum. It seems to always be Groundhog Day at American elections. It's extraordinary. We have Mr. Biden, who seems to be having some kinds of problems. But it also, when he does say anything, it's in many ways more dangerous than what we hear from the rather dangerous president. I noticed that Biden says that he would take care of Venezuela. He says about China, and I found this extraordinary. We have to go in there to know what happened, or what's happening on COVID-19. Go in there. Is an American thinking he can talk like that?
Well, of course. But
so when you think about that, I mean, your writing is so important to this. How do the what do you make of this American problem of the two parties that seem to be one party?
Well, that's the problem. The problem is that, I mean, that was not part of the Constitution, by the way, but it has become this two-party system that doesn't allow any new voices to get very far. And of course, it's the same interests that control both parties. And besides that, it's not only they control the parties, above all, they control I have to use the term deep state, because recent years have simply proven that there is such a thing. The policies go on. And the deep state is very much hostile to Trump because he's not quite one of theirs. And they are doing everything to sabotage him, of course. I mean, he's totally incompetent and should never, he's not what is needed, shall we put it that way. But Biden is even worse because he is simply a tool of that deep state. And sometimes someone like Bolton comes along and wants to make war here, there, and elsewhere, and then he's complaining that Trump wasn't ready enough to make war. Well, Biden would be. Biden would be perfectly ready, because he'll just be a puppet of the system, aside from being perhaps having some difficulties mentally. But I don't know that it even matters, because I don't know that he's even real. I think he's just the instrument. I think he's a puppet of the establishment.
Yes, a predictable figure.
I think it'd be even worse, because right now there's a few signs in Europe of thinking maybe we don't like being bossed around by the United States because Trump is there and they don't like Trump. But if Trump is defeated, there'll be another like there was with Obama. Oh, hooray. America is so wonderful. They got rid of Trump. So let's go on being servants of Washington, which is what European leaders are today.
Yes. Speaking to Diana Johnson and coming to the end of this great opportunity, I have to say, Diana, well, the title, Circle in the Darkness, it's your father used that line, and you said he didn't know where it came from. I'm trying to remember, where did it come from?
Well, it may have come from other people. You know, he saw that this image, he liked this image. I looked it up and found that that Einstein had said approximately that. So I put the quote from Einstein in the front of the book. But my father wasn't quoting Einstein. He had this image, and he thought he'd read it somewhere, but he didn't know where. But it's really I'm really quoting my father, not Einstein.
Anyway, I really think it's brilliant, titled Circle in the Darkness, Memoir of a World Watcher. And I want to say lastly, I Alexander Coburn, and you refer to him in your book. And of course, I read you and followed your writing in Counterpunch. And you had this episode with those people. And I want to say that you are, in my view, very much in the Alexander Coburn tradition. This argument about whether or not you have to have some sort of orthodoxy before you associate with people called progressives or left or center or right. Coburn was one of the people who opened the door on that topic. I remember very vividly that he said, "I like talking to conservative groups." I read that. So when I saw this discussion of your work with people who, under the banner of Counterpunch, they weren't in the, that's not the spirit of Alexander Coburn. You and Caitlin Johnson are the spirit of Alexander Coburn.
Well, you said it. I don't have to say it.
Is that a fair picture? What's your memory? I mean, I thought he was one of the people who sort of opened the windows a little bit and said, let's get some fresh air on these topics.
I mean, he wasn't afraid to debate with anybody. And this whole thing of, the left, we mustn't speak to these people. That's a sign of very serious weakness. I mean, if you can't defend your position arguing with people and have to shut them up, there's something wrong with your position, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think it's very sad that, I mean, Counterpunch still publishes good articles. I'm not going to, I don't like to, but the fact is I think it's very unfortunate that they have ended up endorsing a really dangerous tendency, which is this Antifa.
Yes.
Which I think in the United States they pronounce it Antifa, which sounds to me like a Caribbean resort. It's Antifa for anti-fascist, but this is a...
Not a resort I would like to stay in.
but really, I think this is very dangerous because it misleads young people who really lack political education into a kind of activism which is only destructive, and which in fact enforces the dominant establishment.
Well, also the censorship and the that sort of odd, almost American Protestant righteousness of driving wilderness idea. Sometimes I think that these people who are attacking you think that they're going to be part of the rapture. they can judge everybody. And by the way, the writing becomes more and more shallow. I like your sense of historical continuity with family history. And I think of Alexander Coburn, I say, how about a little respect for his father, Claude Coburn?
Yes.
If they read him, I think they'd really be unhappy. But Alexander's quite proud of his father.
Yeah, well, yes, I guess this is an old-fashioned thing that I never was rebelling against male domination. On the contrary, I was grateful for the wisdom and understanding of my father, and I'm not too happy to see everything collapsing, including families.
Yeah. Well, Diana, it's been great talking to you. This is a great book, Circle in the Darkness, Memoir of a World Watcher. It is full of fantastic things, including your interviewing Ayatollah Khomeini. I didn't know all these things. And your picture of Olaf Palm and what happened. I wish we could talk about it all. I hope we can talk to you again sometime in the near future about these topics that we've been taking up today.
Well, thank you very much. It's been really nice talking to you and hearing what you have to say and exchanging views. And I appreciate it very much.
Thank you very, very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.